So that's what you really need to feel comfortable about. If you get pressure from any source, whether it's parents advising, social media to throw an application out there,
Cheers.
no, it's not ready, then you just gotta use your own judgment and not do it. But you'll know when you're ready. You'll absolutely know it. And trust me, that's the best position to be in because you have all the choices to make when that cycle is over, and it's not that you're settling for anything at the end.
Welcome to Admission Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and successfully. Your host is Accepted's founder and world-renowned admissions guru, Linda Abraham. At Accepted, our mission is to get you to that unforgettable moment when you read your acceptance email and shout, "Yes, I'm in!" Confident you'll be attending the perfect program to help you launch the career of your dreams.
Welcome to the 580th episode of Admission Straight Talk. Thanks for joining me. Are you ready to apply to your dream medical schools? Are you competitive at your target programs? Accepted's med school admissions quiz can give you a quick reality check. Just go to accepted.com/med quiz, complete the quiz, and you'll not only get an assessment, but tips on how to improve your chances of acceptance. Plus, it's all free. You can't beat that deal. Again, take the quiz at accepted.com/med quiz to obtain your free assessment. Our guest today, it's a return guest, fortunately, is Daryl Neighbors, Assistant Dean for Admissions and Recruitment at Loyola University Chicago Stritch School of Medicine. Daryl earned his bachelor's and master's degrees from Whittier College and Golden Gate University, respectively. He then held various admissions positions from 2000 to 2005 before joining the University of Chicago's admissions staff. And there he served in different roles until 2015. He joined Loyola College Stritch in 2015 as Director of Admissions and became the Assistant Dean for Admissions and Recruitment in February 2019. Hello, Daryl. Welcome back to Admission Straight Talk.
Good to see you again, Linda. Thank you for having me back.
My pleasure. It's been too long since you've been on, so I'm really glad that we're doing this.
Oh, I'm glad you asked me. I'm glad you asked me to come back.
Great. So what is, just to start with and just give everybody an overview, what is distinctive, what are the distinctive elements to the Loyola Stritch approach to medical education?
Well, we're one of four Jesuit medical schools in the country. So, I think that by virtue of that, there tends to be sort of an understanding within the collective consideration of our institution about the path to medicine being similar to that of one who discerns their vocation very comprehensively. So within the scope of that discernment, we apply a lot of the same principles that might be applied in any kind of Jesuit environment, which is to obviously think of others first in supporting efforts that are more social justice oriented, being a global thinker, to be proactive and engaged when you sense or see a problem, that you don't, resist the urge to do something about it, that you are putting into motion perhaps an understanding of the situation and then kind of utilizing your resources to understand what needs to be done and then, pursuing a path to mitigate that which you see as an injustice or an inadequacy or an inefficiency. And I believe that, within the scope of that also is the added element of compassion for others. Not just that you're supporting the goals of others, that you're helping others, but that you have a passion to do that and a passion to, build equality among, populations where that may not be the case. So if you apply that, sort of Jesuit ideal within the realm of education, which is where my doctorate is
being. I didn't know you had a doctorate. I'm sorry.
Well, no, I don't have it yet. I'm pursuing one.
Oh, you're pursuing
yes.
It. Okay.
I'm about a year away, but the thing that helped me affirm the sort of Jesuit pedagogy is taking classes myself, not in the medical school, but adjacent in another program, because then I could understand the pedagogical link, right? I could understand reflection as a means to solve problems. I can then understand why principally we focus our efforts on underserved populations because of the opportunity that exists to help a great number who are underserved, but also the potential to mitigate further consequences as a result of their being ignored, right? Mm-hmm. These are all essential elements of the Jesuit culture. So I would suggest that, you know, there is a culture in mind here when you are becoming a member of this community. And I further understood that when I went to Italy a couple of years ago for a class. I spent mm-hmm. an entire summer there.
Wow.
It was really hot. But other than that, I learned a lot about, you know, the essential element of the Loyola name, right? The idea of Saint Ignatius being a martyr and being a saint and being a part of this global culture recognition of what that means, his life being lived for others, his life being lived to teach others ethical responsibility, to teach others how to serve and provide compassion to others, how to solve problems reflectively, how to just think in an introspective way. And those things are still at play in many communities around the world. So for us to have an opportunity to build that environment within our learning environment and within our care environment. So right now we have students who are out there in the world, you know, mm-hmm. working on missions, you know, in Bolivia and Belize and other parts of South America. And, you know, so that's part of the culture of this space. And that's an expectation that we have when we look at an application. We want to understand if a student is compelled by this environment, compelled by doing those things. And if they are, I think they'll come out of this environment much better practitioners than if they had chosen to go to another institution.
Okay. What if, let's say, one shares the very noble ideals that you just enunciated, but isn't of the Catholic faith or is of no faith?
Well, you know, I think faith is a part of cultural identity mm-hmm. for many, mm-hmm. but it's also something that many of us don't recognize as being a part of our everyday life. But I think in essence, what is most important in this environment is to understand how people are compelled by faith. So before we got on the podcast, we were talking about personal situations, personal mm-hmm. stories. One of the things I didn't mention in that instance was the decision was made to have care at a hospital that is Catholically affiliated, right? And when I asked the question why, there's always a spiritual element to that. There's always a reason that's important to the patient. And as a Catholic hospital that is very front-facing as a Catholic hospital, it represents Loyola. And remember what I said about Loyola being a global brand, right? Mm-hmm, a global brand that represents and means many things to many people. So if I'm sick—
What should it mean?
Well, again, all the things that I described, yeah. You know, okay. The life okay. of St. Ignatius and, you know, principally if you go to an Ignatian high school or, you know, I know many students that have gone to parochial schools or secondary schools where there's been a affiliation with Ignatius or Jesuits. I mean, they're all the same. I mean, Jesuits mm. and Ignatian spirituality are all the same element.
Okay.
But they've learned certain principles in those environments and they gravitate to them throughout their lives. But ultimately, when a patient is sick, they gravitate towards things that are important to them. And so that becomes the element of our experience, right? When we have mm-hmm. patients here, they're drawn here in many cases by their faith, by their understanding and recognition of Loyola as being a place where they will be treated with compassion and care. So that's very important, you know, and that right. in that example I provided to you before the call, that's the reason why the decision was made, because of the care model, the way right. that the patients were treated, the way that the staff cared for the patients.
Well, I've had, you know, relatives also at various mm-hmm. Catholic institutions. I don't know if they're affiliated with the Jesuits or not, but they were yeah. definitely Catholic and the care yeah. was excellent.
Right, right. So I think there's an element of understanding that. So if you are Muslim, faith is obviously important to you. So it shouldn't be a surprise that a patient is drawn to an environment because of their faith. It's that faith and that understanding and recognition of the importance of faith that compels, I think, us to see that student potentially as a good fit for this environment. So it really doesn't have to do with the, you know, the religion you practice, but I think it is important to have an understanding of the importance of faith to others. You know, we don't obviously, because of AMCAS and all the other restrictions, we don't question candidates about their religious backgrounds. If they want to tell us that information, they're free to do that, but we're not going to make any discerning kind of considerations about their application because of that. But when you provide a candidate with the platform to just speak about faith, even when you're not making it a direct request, you know, like we're just telling them, mm-hmm. what does our mission mean to them? Like you get a lot of really, you know, detailed and historical longitudinal perspectives about not just themselves, but their family and the connections their families have had to that faith element. And in many cases, that's inspired them to move towards medicine. So I think it has a lot of importance to a lot of people. Everyone doesn't express faith the same way or recognize it in the same way. But I think if you do recognize it and you do understand it, you also understand how it can compel others. And I think that's primarily the benefit of having an environment like this, because we bring students from all sorts of religious backgrounds. When things are happening in the world and there's contention and discord, our students come together and mm-hmm. embrace the idea that they're serving a higher power by virtue of being here and learning, and that their faith is helping to inspire that. I had my doubts coming from a very heavy research institution coming to a Catholic institution, and whether or not I would feel comfortable. I've always felt comfortable here. I'm not Catholic.
Okay.
Those questions that I get about Catholic faith, I'm not really sure, like what, you know, that might mean. When we have Mass, I often don't know when to stand up or sit down. But you know, it's the feeling I get being in that environment and seeing people who are passionate about their faith. I feel like that helps me at times, because I'm very spiritual. And I recognize that faith is important to me. I just really haven't put a name to it like many people have.
Got it. Okay, great. Going in a completely different direction mm-hmm. from faith, from ancient faiths, AI. Can't get much more different than from faith to AI, right?
Yeah.
How is AI affecting medical education at Stritch, if at all?
Well, right now, I think it's just a very comprehensive conversation about the utility of it. I think there are obviously some concerns. The initial part of it were the concerns. In my realm, in admissions, the red flags have been flying for a couple of years about candidates using AI to write their applications, to write their essays. Do we have a mechanism to prevent that from happening? So, you know, there have been discussions about that. At the end of the day, being disingenuous, it's very easy to spot. And that's definitely something that would rate a person down in our process, if not completely out. So, you know, I don't know if, I mean, obviously as a student currently, I recognize that some of my classmates might be using AI to stimulate some response to a prompt or stimulate some response to a question at a greater level that needs to have more detail to substantiate, you know, whatever assertions being made. But, you know, in the world of the pre-med, if it's the goal to address a question and to be as compelling as possible, you know, AI serves that purpose, but is it your experience, right? And I think
it can rarely go into the depth that you need.
Exactly. And so I think that that's sort of the cautionary consideration in terms of admissions. And medical education as a whole, there's probably many different ways that this could benefit. I mean, I think of simulation all the time.
Yeah.
We have an ophthalmology lab, a VR lab, and I feel like that is, if I were to sort of speculate that that is a form of AI, I mean, it wasn't presented to me as such, but, you know, when I put the goggles on and I'm in this immersive environment and I see a big eyeball in front of me and I'm able to twist it and turn it and go inside of it with my hands.
Wow.
Like to me, that seems like artificial intelligence. it may or may not be, but it's certainly an amazing learning tool. Sure. And if I to be an ophthalmologist, I would bend over backwards to have that as part of my training environment. So I think that there will be, if there aren't already, you know, applications of it, especially in the clinical training environment, because I think that's where it's really essential. Because if you can consider in training, like how many different cases are you going to be able to see before you graduate? With AI, you could literally see any case you wanted, right? And if you're programming, like we use mannequins in our simulation lab, if you can program a mannequin to do anything that's possible for a human to do, and that's a great tool for training. Sure. So I certainly think it hasn't, and I know that we have a simulation lab and I know that we do those things. You know, the mannequins we use tend to be directed by, they're not autonomous, they're directed by someone. So someone has to pull the levers to flip the switches behind the glass to make it bleed or to, you know, have the baby come out, whatever. But, you know, I think, you know, at some point that technology will progress. That mannequin will probably be 5 times the cost. But it probably would reduce the need to have the person behind the glass, because now the AI functions autonomously. And now this isn't, for all intent and purposes, a patient, you know?
Right. Right. Amazing idea. Yeah. World's changing.
I know. It's kind of scary, but it is.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing, the potential.
Right.
But let's look at the application. So you have a pretty extensive secondary. What I recall, I was looking at it before.
We just updated it. So
okay, it's going to change.
Yes, we've just applied a change. We've got to get it programmed in. Actually, more than one change. The one change I'm most proud of, if we can make it happen. So if it doesn't, I guess having it out there, either on a podcast, not great. But I'm trying to implement some sort of sound file, so the candidates can actually tell us their name.
Really?
Speak it into the system and then provide a pronunciation for us, a phonetic pronunciation, using a standard that we provide. So that actually would be like one of the new questions.
That's like a fairly easy one to answer.
Yeah, it's pretty easy. I don't necessarily think that's taxing, but it's essential.
It might be taxing to you to set up, but I don't think it's taxing.
But once it's set up, I mean, it's going to be great. It's going to be great for us, because now we're making connections with students and we're not embarrassing ourselves by trying to say names that we don't understand or, you know, making the candidate feel bad when they visit us. And again, I think if we're able to maintain that file and, you know, the candidate comes into the medical school, now we can share that with faculty. So now everyone knows who that person is. And, you know, obviously there's touch points that are really important. I think that's definitely one of them. The other questions that we utilize, again, we've modified them because what we look at in one cycle, we kind of get a sense for a question's response and how the patterns of response go. And we might think to ourselves, well, you know, they're addressing the question, but can they take it a little further? And if they did take it a little further, would this address questions to us about the candidates in general? And I would say that most of those questions tend to be questions of behavior. Like, what kind of behavior does this predict? Or what type of response did this particular situation engender for this person? And what kind of change did it make to their original path? We're always trying to get candidates to extend their opportunities to dialogue. And that is another essential element of the Jesuit model. It is to reflect and to provide a pretty consistent baseline of understanding and evidence to support the assertions that a person makes. And so the prompts that we set up are, in many cases, designed to do that. Some of them are more structured to sort of help us understand what they understand about our mission or what they know about the Jesuit environment. So, you know, just like you mentioned in your question, you know, that's a big mystery to some people. So just trying to understand where they're coming from, you know, did they accidentally apply to us or did they really intend to, right? And then once we get beyond that, you know, again, it's really trying to understand behaviors. And I can say absolutely 100% that behaviors are predictive and they often don't change. So if a candidate has evidence of a behavior and that behavior is not, let's say, trending up in the right direction, then that it's going to be hard for us to see any way for that to change without the candidate expressing that they have remediated the behavior or that they have done things tangibly to, you know, put them on a different path.
They've accepted the gift of change.
Exactly. Or sought the advice they need to make the change possible. So that's where we're really going with the mandatory secondary questions. We have mandatory secondary questions, and then there are some that are not mandatory because they don't apply to everyone.
So you are anticipating some changes, but just bottom line, other than speaking their name, you are anticipating some changes to the secondary to help applicants dig a little deeper and gain a better understanding. Got it. One of the things I noticed on your website is that it conveniently provides a lot of data about the average number of research hours, paid clinical experience. I think the first one was 1,545 hours of research experience, 1,498 hours of paid clinical experience, 599 hours of clinical service, and non-medically based service was 548 hours. This is per admitted student in the M1 class. You're one of the first schools that I've seen do this, which I think is actually really helpful to students.
Yeah, I mean, that's an average. I think in some ways it might be more anxiety or inducing than anything else. But here's what I've often shared is that, you know, this is an average of all the candidates who are matriculating into our program. So within the construct of any of these hours, you're talking about, like, you know, paid clinical hours, that's a pretty high number. And so when I think about, like, how to articulate this to a candidate, I'm really telling them three things. This is out of 170 individuals, this is an average of the hours that they have utilized for this experience, which means that if you were looking at this as a, you know, a spread of hours, you know, if we're looking at this longitudinally or putting all of these on a graph, like, there's going to be probably 15 that have exceeded the maximum number of hours. So let's say 10,000 hours or more. There might be individuals.
I see there's a bell curve.
Correct. Right. Mm-hmm. But that curve may be a little bit more slanted, right? It may not be exactly a perfect bell. Mm-hmm. So what we're saying is that, you know, on the one hand, there are some candidates out there that are exceeding the hours that normally would be bringing down the average. And there's a reason for that, though. The reason that that's happening and the reason there are more than there have been in the past is because candidates are taking more time to build on their experiences before they apply. This doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do that, but this is a trend, you know? Yeah. So it's indicative of a trend. So if a curious candidate were to ask more questions about this, which does happen a lot, then I simply tell them, like, you know, thinking about this from perspective of average age. When I started here, the average age of our first year class was 23. Now it's 25. Okay. So over the course of, you know, I've been here 8-9 years, that gradually has increased. And I would even suggest that if you were to focus on the past 5 years, that increase would be the same. In other words, that increase has really been within the last 5 years. So we could say, you know, there's an effect based on the pandemic and the delay that the pandemic caused for many to get clinical experiences. But what it also means is that students were not ready to apply, or they took their time in applying and they gave themselves more time to dive into these experiences, which are very important to discern for oneself if medicine is the right vocation for you. A lot of candidates are kind of going through this really quickly, and this is starting to build more now. I think there's an adverse trend now. I've met a lot of candidates in this cycle who are applying as rising seniors. And
really?
And it's against the advice of their advisors.
It's also a reversal of the trend.
Correct. And this is indicative of what happens a lot in this process, is that trends come and go. At some point, this trend where people are taking more time will probably abate. We'll probably see the class start to become more aligned with this 1 or 2 year pattern that is pretty typical. But, you know, I think it also speaks to the idea of, you know, what many candidates are experiencing is going out into the social media environment and trying to figure things out. And what they're going to see, the majority of them are going to see students really anxious about getting things going and not taking that extra time.
And sometimes their parents.
Right. Yeah, there's that factor as well. But I think when you combine the parent factor with the crowdsourcing factor and often the lack of advising, you know, that's typically what you get. I mean, there's been plenty of students that I've seen who have advising and are not listening to the advice, but there are even more that have no advising and are just kind of, you know, playing it by ear or using crowdsourcing as their, you know, the best way to approach this situation. But you're absolutely right about parents. That does come up a lot. The statement is always like, my parents don't understand why I would take time off. You know, in some cases,
they shouldn't be thinking of it as taking time off.
Yeah, exactly.
They should be working. They should be pursuing their goals.
Or just, you know, kind of regirding oneself for the next phase of this process. You know, there's nothing wrong with, you know, collecting oneself and putting everything in the right place and a proper perspective to move forward in an application process. So timing is everything in this experience. And some people are just not ready because they may not have had the formative experiences that others have had, but, you know, they may disregard that if they're looking at a post on Reddit, or they may disregard that if they're talking to a person that they met who is, you know, actively engaged in applying to medical school, who is maybe a lot more certain about that opportunity. And, you know, again, I think thinking about yourself in terms of your readiness, far more important. You know, the MCAT is one indicator that tends to be an outlier in that respect, because I think a lot of candidates really push themselves to take the MCAT when they're not ready. And they may get a score back that may not be indicative of the best work they can do, but they still continue to apply. And if you're not successful after that first attempt with that MCAT, then you really got to rethink, is this the right timing? And just maybe putting a patch on that isn't really going to help. Just taking the MCAT again may not necessarily help. I mean, it may be a sign that you might need a little bit more time. And there's nothing wrong with that. I keep telling people, and I really share the story about me, you know, going through my doctorate now, because, you know, I'm in my early 50s. It's not medical school, but, you know, I did a lot of things before I decided to do this. And I'm pretty mm-hmm. certain this is what I want to do. So, you know, it can take a little bit of time to be certain about those things, but it doesn't have to happen while you're in undergrad. It doesn't have to be like this automatic switch that you convert to, because it is a much more challenging environment. It's a much more demanding environment. It takes into account the fact that you've already made the decision about going into this vocation, and now you're ready to do the work to get there. But I've seen a lot of medical students at some point in my career who rethink that. And they say to themselves, I didn't really think that it would be this hard, and I don't know if I want to do this anymore. And the majority of those people had parents that were pushing them, you know,
right.
But that's not, to me, that's not a surprise given, you know, the population of pre-meds now. A lot of them are still one parent physician, two parents physician, like half the pool, perhaps. I don't know if that mm-hmm. many, but it seems like that many. And, you know, often it's the case we're really trying to figure out, is this really their decision, or is this something that they feel is like a legacy that they have to continue? And so right. it does take a little bit more introspection to get an answer to that question.
I interviewed for the podcast somebody several years ago whose father wanted him to become a physician, mm-hmm. and largely because his father wanted him to, he didn't want to.
Right.
And then the father unfortunately passed away suddenly while he was in college, mm-hmm. and he still didn't want to be a physician, mm-hmm. but somehow I think he became an EMT. Anyway, he ultimately decided to become a physician, and was very happy he did, but yeah. it had to be his decision.
Right.
And that's, I think that's what sometimes children of physicians struggle with.
Right.
The other thing I just wanted to, two thoughts that came through my mind as you were speaking. One is that the applicants or the students who are in college are really determined to get through the college and go straight into medical school. And they want to do the clinical volunteering, and they want to do the community service volunteering, and they want to get some research in, and they want to, you know, take the MCAT after their junior year, and they want to get good grades. Well, all the time demands of those first four items don't support and help you get really good grades.
Exactly.
So if you say, you know, I'm not going to put that kind of pressure on myself, if I start medical school a year or 2 years after I graduate college, I'll be able to take advantage of my college experience in a much richer way. Right. I'll be able to get the experience I want. I'll be able to confirm that medicine is the right path for me, which is your point. And I'll just be more ready and be a better candidate.
Right.
And that, I think, is something that's frequently lost on right. those who just, I got to get, you know, I want to get going. I want to get going.
Right.
Parents are pushing them.
Yeah. And again, I think that's part of the advising structure, maybe the absence of it in some cases. You know, a lot of large undergraduate institutions just don't have the bandwidth to support every student's application process. So then they're forced to form these groups on campus. I'm not going to name the school, but I interviewed quite a few of these candidates, and I was told, because I recognize they don't have the advising structure, but I was told that this is a process that has been happening for quite some time to form these groups on campus to support students' efforts to apply to medical school, to give them the opportunity to compel or link to clinical experiences and opportunities. So now you have students essentially doing the work that a lot of advising teams would do, which is to engage physicians into shadowing opportunities for students or observational opportunities. And then that leads, if you're proactive, which many of these students are, that leads to additional opportunities once they get that chance. But that's what's happening. Students are really supporting one another. And that, I think, builds momentum. So I don't think that having momentum is a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. But I think the reality is you have to really know personally where you are compared to everyone else, and then just kind of let everyone else do their thing and just independently focus on whether or not, like you said, you're ready to do all of those things, that all those considerations are balanced, that you have, you know, an application that works for you because you have taken an MCAT that you want to forward on, because you consider the courses you've taken, you know that the courses you've taken have prepared you well. You know, sometimes I see applications, I'm like, and you don't see either one of those things, but the candidate is not really being honest with themselves about what they see, or even more importantly, what that predicts in medical school. So that's the thing I'm always trying to help them understand, like the predictive nature of what they're telling me or showing me or showing the committee is really what determines the impression the committee has. No matter what you say or try to tell, not show, but tell, is not going to mitigate what is seen in the trending or what's seen in the transcript or what's seen in the outcomes, right? Because I believe everyone will do what they have to succeed, but at the same time, can you do that without delay? Can you do that while progressing in a very academically rigorous environment? Can you do that in an environment that's going to demand of you your time and your efforts and very quickly move forward, rather than taking the time you might need to rethink things that are happening? So that's the thing about medical school. The pace is just unrelenting.
Right.
And it's constantly moving on to the next course or moving on to the next level and passing through the benchmarks without delay. So when a candidate shows me a transcript, says that they're ready to go into medical school and they've taken the MCAT six times, I say to myself, well, does this predict that you're going to take the boards, the step one, six times? Because you can't do that, right? At some point, you have to really understand like how you can maintain success in the standardized testing environment without having to do it that many times,
right? For sure.
You know, think about all the costs, think about all the effort, think about all the anxiety, think about all the delay, right? All those things compound and build that anxiety. So, and that's the thing that really makes medical school hard. And when you start to see your peers advance and you're still in the same classification, that's another indication you're not ready. But at that point, you don't really have a choice. You've got to make it work. And I can tell many students at that point are thinking to themselves, I wish I'd taken more time.
Right. For sure. Just going back to those stats I cited about the paid clinical experience and the clinical service numbers. If I were just to look at those stats, I might assume that Stritch values paid clinical experience as much or more than volunteer clinical experience. Are those numbers just a reflection of the trend that we were talking about, or does it reflect Stritch's values? In other words, if you just volunteer, is that somehow worse than if you get a job?
No, it's a reflection of the trend. I mean, there's far fewer experiences coded as volunteer.
Okay.
And certainly far fewer hours.
Right.
Particularly in the clinical arena, because this is the thing that most candidates are most compelled with when it comes to clinical experiences. It's not necessarily the service part of it. It's the application and the execution and whether or not it's going to resound to the committee. Am I going to be licensed? Am I going to be certified? Am I going to have a level of progression within this clinical realm that demonstrates that I'm ready to see patients or to have that experience of seeing patients? I think that ultimately service, unfortunately, has been consigned to this sideline of, well, it's just inherent in what I do. You know, if I'm going to get up and go to work and see patients, that's service. And it also, in my opinion, it also suggests that within the pre-med culture, there has been a redirect from service to clinical because of the challenge of getting clinical experiences underfoot. And especially when you think about that 4 years of undergrad. Okay. So the thing that I would say, if you're doing 4 years of undergrad, knowing you're doing a gap year, what we tend to see is more service. We see more service in that 4 year construct because they're of the mind that I can wait until I'm done with undergrad to really focus on this clinical experience. I'm going to pivot to do scribing. I'm going to pivot to go into clinical research. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to enjoy, like you said, my undergraduate experience. I'm going to be of service to others. I'm going to, you know, do local leadership here. I'm going to do service over here. I'm going to, you know, do mission trips, those types of things. But once they leave medical or leave undergrad, those service engagements start to diminish because they're more focused on either remediation of grades, doing a post-bac or a graduate program, or focusing on a longitudinal work-oriented clinical experience because that's how they build up that experience. So service becomes minimized in that setting. So we're seeing that really hitting the post-bacs much harder in terms of limited service. So that's why that construct across all 170 candidates has, you know, a value that is significantly less in terms of the average.
Okay. Does Loyola Stritch require shadowing?
I think it's a practical thing to do for all candidates. I wouldn't say that it's the most significant thing you can do. As I mentioned, I think that you really have to find an opportunity to engage in a patient-oriented experience, whether that's scribing, which is not really hands-on. It's obviously, again, a lot of observation, but there's so much work and so much interaction with the clinical care team in that position that it does satisfy our kind of considerations for whether or not the candidate is knowledgeable about medicine, knowledgeable about work and a care team, has really seen the environment firsthand and not through someone else's perspective. So I think that shadowing is reasonable if you're trying to just assert whether or not this is the right vocation or the right you know, experience that you want to pursue. But I think once you've made that decision, you really have to pivot into something that's a little bit more tangible in terms of your time and effort to really make the case that you've tested your assertion and that you are in fact focused on this vocation. And again, it doesn't necessarily have to be that I want to be this type of physician, but that this is the type of environment of training that is suitable for me.
Okay, great. Thank you. Now, This podcast should air on June 11th. If someone hasn't submitted their primary by June 11th, or let's say even in June, okay, mm-hmm. are they doomed?
Oh, no.
Are they late? No. I know no. that, but I mean.
Yeah, I mean, we don't even.
Reddit rumors abound.
Well, there you go. I mean, you just got to. I just got off the phone with a young woman and she was so adamant about this thing. And then when I really pressed her to tell me where she got it from, she said it was a student. I was like, you can't listen to students. You can, but you know, you can't, you know, if I need financial advice, I'm not going to ask a student. Okay. So here you go. That's my advice. Treat application to medical school like financial advice. Okay. Ask a professional. So, no, I don't think it's late because we don't actually pull the download in until July. So, you know, so I think that's important for candidates out there to understand. AMCAS will compel you to submit your application in May. Once the primary application is given to them, then it's verified. Okay. So that verification could take 2 weeks. It could take 6 weeks.
Right.
That's what really determines when your application goes to the medical schools. If the medical schools are ready to receive that application when it comes to them, then you receive a secondary application. So for us, we don't actually start looking at those in our system until late June. So the earliest that we would send a supplemental application to anyone is, I think, the second week of July. So I would say that would not be late. Now, if you were to say August, or September, again, thinking about verification being 6 weeks, maybe 4 weeks. Now that application isn't getting to the medical school until September or October. And then you're getting the secondary. Remember, it's not complete until you finish the secondary. So, right. So all that time that's elapsing is really now happening in an active cycle where you have interviews and all that's happening. So I would say, if you're preparing your application while active interviews are going on, then yeah, that's too late.
All right. Now, per our last conversation, as well as, again, I look at your website before the call, Stritch is open to updates. What events are you interested in learning more about once applicants have submitted their primary and secondary applications? How much is too much in terms of quantity, and what is insignificant in terms of quality?
Well, this is one way I know that people are listening to your podcast, Linda, yeah. Because I mentioned this, was it like 3 years ago I did your podcast?
I think it's longer. That's why I said it's been too long.
It's been a while. Ever since then, we've started to see updates from applicants increase. Remember what I told you at that point was that we don't tell applicants about the update process. We only tell them once they interview. And then once they've interviewed, we help them focus on three types of updates.
Okay.
But we've been seeing those types of updates coming to us from the primary pool. So they're obviously listening to your podcast and getting that advice. We always suggest three of the types of updates that are most effective are an academic update. So this is for those, remember I said, you know, there's a large trend now applying into, you know, like your senior year. So you may have coursework that has not been, you know, part of your process of discernment and that verification. When you submit your AMCAS application, they're going to want to know what your predicted courses are. So if you're submitting your application and you've started those courses and you haven't received an interview yet, good thing to do might be to just let the school know, hey, these are my first semester, or this is my first trimester outcomes, or these are the classes that I'm taking, or these are the classes I've changed, or I just started taking this class and this is what's happened. This has been great. Like, academic updates can not only assert that the individual is interested, but provide some context to what may have been seen in the transcript or changes that may have been made. So academic, absolutely. Professional, absolutely. This is even more pronounced because we're seeing a lot more candidates anticipating hours of experiences rather than having them completed. And so if you're anticipating the majority of your hours in a clinical experience that hasn't really started at the time of your application, then that's a great opportunity for you to provide updates. And we call those professional updates. So, you know, I've been in this position as a scribe for a month. I coded this in my AMPCAS application as anticipating X number of hours. Those hours have increased, decreased. I'm working with a different, you know, physician than I wrote about in my application because I'm doing such a great job working for the internal medicine person I'm scribing for. I had this patient encounter. This was great. You know, those updates, again, help us understand interest, but also provide context to what we're seeing in the application. And then the third is personal update. Mm-hmm. So anything of a personal nature that might need to be availed to us. And this runs the gamut. You know, I think particularly for students who are applying with statuses that are a bit challenging. So like we've had a lot of refugees and asylees applying to us over the past couple of years. We've also seen a lot more undocumented students who are not able to receive DACA status applying into the pool and asking for a remedy. Like, how do I keep my application active? So many of them are using adjustment of status. Many of them are using asylee refugee. Many of them are using temporary protected status within their applications where they are describing their citizenship. And we allow those applications to come through and we review them, but it's always important in those particular cases to provide updates. So a personal update in that instance would be, you know, this is my process towards adjusting my status, or any update that would refer back to the citizenship status that is kind of working towards a goal of permanent residency or, you know, whatever the case may be in terms of the outcome. So I think those are really important, but we see a lot of, to provide a letter of intent before you're interviewed, I think is a little bit presumptive. I would certainly wait until you've applied to a school before you intend to matriculate, because it doesn't really ring true if you're going to do it.
Well, you already applied. That's kind of your intent.
Right. But I mean, if you're writing a letter of intent, you're essentially saying, I'm going to your medical school if given an offer. And at the application phase, I mean, what does that say? Does that say we're your only choice?
You apply to all other 19 schools that you apply to by air and air?
Right. Or maybe you've just given everyone a letter of intent, right?
Or maybe that too.
Yeah.
Right? Which is,
I mean, we don't really know what that means.
Right.
So if on the other side of that, if you interview with us and you provide a letter of intent, well, guess what you provide? You provide a lot of detail as to why.
Right.
This is what I experienced on the interview day. This is what I experienced in my research. This is the feeling I got when I was in person on that interview day. You know, those are things that resonate with the committee and are, I think, more believable.
Yeah, a little bit more credible. Sure.
Right.
Sure.
But like a personal update can really just be anything that the candidate feels they need to share.
All right. We've covered a lot here. What advice do you have for applicants interested in applying to Loyola Stritch? Not so much this cycle, because I think you've given a lot of outstanding advice for that, but they're looking to 25, 26. They're not with the trend that we discussed earlier, you know, people applying straight from college. They're thinking ahead to 25, 26, or even later.
Yeah.
So they're earlier in the process. What would you recommend to them?
Well, we see them all the time. It's part of recruitment. We have an Aspire program with an applicant bootcamp workshop series involved. So we're looking at candidates who are 2 years away. Mm-hmm. Here's what we basically are trying to help them understand. We're trying to help them understand, first of all, you know, like think about your rationale for wanting to go to medical school. Really understand why you want to do this. I mean, obviously, the more you think about that why, the easier it is to sort of share with others, right? And if you're sharing it with others who are clinicians, who are educators, they're going to support your efforts, especially if you're a good person who is actively engaged in the work that you're doing, is, you know, someone that is service oriented. Again, like this tends to be kind of in that 4-year wheelhouse of undergrad. So service is definitely tied to that discernment. We also talk to them about really the timing of the application, when to determine if you're ready, but not to force the idea of readiness. You know, one of the presentations that I put together is it just kind of describes all the different things that go into this process, all the different variables of consideration in a committee process. So if you're laying that out like a map and you're saying to yourself, I've really done a lot of this, but not a lot of this, you know, you really got to think about balance. You really got to think about putting it all together. Obviously, I think in undergrad, you just have to do the things that you're interested in. I've talked to music majors. I've talked to, you know, athletes, students that actually thought they were going to become athletes or become musicians, right? So, and then I think it's good. I think it's good that they've had the opportunity to really think about another profession, another vocation, another passion that they have. But when they come back into this realm and decide that they're going into medical school or that they want to do medicine, like they really have to think more about helping the committee understand, like, why have you made this decision and how are you determined not to change your mind again? Because now you've got an investment of time and money. And a process where, you know, we give you a seat and you choose not to take it to its fullest extent. Now we've missed out on giving someone else that chance. And that's our goal, is to provide the workforce with physicians, you know, so we want to be sure that you're sure that this is what you want to do. So if they've got more time, then really it's about timing and helping them articulate their motivation, providing them with the resources and tools to do that. We talk about reflective practice a lot in this program. We give them frameworks of reflection. You can apply a framework of reflection to pretty much any part of the application that is contextual. And if you use that consistently, then guess what? You know, the application makes a lot of sense. When you meet that person in an interview, you're like, oh, this is exactly who I thought I was meeting, not someone completely different. Thanks to AI, right? So, I think, you know, having more time, as I said earlier, to really know this is what you want to do and to find the opportunities to involve yourself in a clinical experience, like that is paramount, because you're starting to build your network. Those individuals that are helping and guiding you are not lost. They're going to be part of a collected network over time. These are people that are going to be part of your support team. So you're starting to build that, and you got to build that really before you get into medical school. It's not the kind of thing you just start on day one of medical school to build. So those are things we try to really encourage, you know, to kind of get a running start at this process versus a cold start.
Sounds good. Thank you. Great advice. What would you have liked me to ask you that I haven't asked?
You always ask this question at the end. I'm always.
That's right.
I think one question, I'm always thinking about like what candidates are thinking. So like, what are the most common mistakes that you see in the application? Number
six. Go for it. That's a great, I love that question actually.
Yeah. So I had a lot of people giving me advice about this.
Okay.
It kind of all goes back to the same idea, not being ready. Right. So we talked about question 16 in my staff meeting today,
Really? Wow.
Because I've got
flattered.
I've got counselors who interact with candidates a lot more than I do. And they do reapplicant counseling. And, you know, they're always talking about like how first, where is the information coming from? What's building the information base for the candidate? And in many cases, just like I mentioned earlier, it's not fact-based. It's a student. It's a social media site. It's something that was crowdsourced, something that's not actually evidenced or factually based in an institution. And I had the experience earlier today of talking to an accepted candidate where I started hearing a lot of misinformation. So, you know, I think that's the most common mistake, is really not getting the advice from the source. And I recognize a lot of medical schools are really hard to interact with. We tend not to be that way. I mean, we try really hard not to be that way. But of course, there's probably someone out there listening that said, you know, I emailed Dean Neighbors like 3 months ago and he never responded. Well, it's probably because I didn't see the email. But no, we try to be transparent. And I think that, you know, pre-meds have to, you know, if they don't have advising, they really have to find a mechanism of advice and resource that is tied to medicine. or more importantly, tied to medical school application that they can trust. I think the other mistake that they're making, and this is sort of a collective thing as well, is just in the anxiousness, the anxiety that my counselors are seeing. And a lot of it is because when they talk to candidates are really focusing on what everyone else is doing. So the perfect example is like the candidate that is taking the MCAT this month to apply in the upcoming cycle, right? I always say, know what's on your application, know what's every part of your application before you apply. And the question they're getting is, well, should I apply and then take the MCAT? Right. And ultimately, why would you do that? Because you don't know what the MCAT result is. And now you've got an application you've spent money on. It's already out there. But when they dive into why the candidates are feeling that way or why they want to do that, despite the fact that they should wait, is it because they feel the anxiety, they feel the pressure, they feel the need to move things forward. So again, I would just, I say it a lot, but, everyone that's applying to medical school is young. And I know what AMCAS says. I think they said there was like a 61-year-old that applied.
Really?
Wow. I would tell that person, that person probably did a lot of evidence, a lot of soul searching to get to that point. They're probably more ready than maybe someone at 22 or 23, right? So what is the principle here? Well, the principle thing is readiness and timeliness. And it can't be on someone else's schedule. It has to be on your schedule. So that's what you really need to feel comfortable about. If you get pressure from any source, whether it's parents, advising, social media to throw an application out there, no, it's not ready, then you just got to use your own judgment and not do it. But you'll know when you're ready. You'll absolutely know it. And trust me, that's the best position to be in because you have all the choices to make when that cycle is over. And it's not that you're settling for anything at the end.
A previous guest gave me this quote, and that is that comparison is the thief of joy.
Mm.
And I just loved it. I think it was Mike Woodson who said it on a previous podcast. I'm sure you know him. Mm-hmm. And apparently Teddy Roosevelt originally said it. But regardless of who originally said it, I think that's absolutely... A, I think it's true. Yeah. And B, I think for medical school applicants, if you're looking at what your peers are doing more than what you should be doing, you're in trouble, whether it's what your peers are doing or what your cousin did or your girlfriend or boyfriend, whatever it is, it may not be right for you.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to figure out what's right for you.
I always say less FOMO, more JOMO, right? FOMO being the fear of missing out. Versus JOMO being the joy of missing out, right?
That's great.
The joy of missing out is that you're on the journey and you're insulated in your cocoon.
But you're on your journey.
Yes.
You're on the one that's meant for you. Journey.
Exactly. And there's great joy in that.
Yeah.
So much more positive joy in that than being on the FOMO train. And, it's not one of those things we can really bet, unfortunately. I mean, we're doing our best, but I think again, behaviors tend to predict that. How candidates write about their own personal stories and motivations helps us to understand that. And this is something I say at the white coat ceremony. I'm always talking about, trying to mitigate FOMO and the fear of missing out and trying to suppress the social media. You're going to have your peers who graduated from high school. Yeah, they're going to be getting married and having lives and you're going to be a student, but there's joy in that. There's a great joy and possibility of what the outcome is for you, because you know what? You can still get married and you can still have children. You can still have that big house, but you're going to be doing something that you love, right? The rest of your life, there's great joy in that. So try to find the joy in the experience. And I know it can be difficult if you don't like standardized testing. So
who does?
Exactly.
Who does? nobody likes it. Nobody likes being tested or evaluated, period.
Right.
It's part of life.
It's part of life. It's definitely part of medical school.
That's for sure. Daryl, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. This has been delightful. I've really enjoyed connecting with you again and hearing your perspective. Now, you gave me the URL for Loyola Chicago Stritch, and I'm just going to say it. It's luc.edu/stritch, STRITCH. And of course, we're going to link to it from accepted.com/580. Listener, you'll find links to Loyola Stritch as well as to related resources and podcasts in the show notes. Again, the URL for that is accepted.com/580. As a last reminder, take the med school admissions quiz, see if you're really ready to apply, and learn what you need to do to improve your chances of acceptance and on your schedule, not on anybody else's. Take the quiz at accepted.com/medquiz today. Listener, thank you too for tuning in to this, our 580th episode. If you found this show helpful, subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or whatever your favorite podcatcher is. You can find subscribe links at accepted.com/580. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I'm your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.